Welcome to the Table Podcast, where we discuss issues of God and culture. Brought to you by Dallas Theological Seminary.
I think you know who I am. This is Joel Rosenberg. It's a pleasure to have Joel with us. What you don't know, I asked the Hendricks Center staff. By the way, let's thank Kim Cook, Pam Cole, Heather Zimmerman, who helped make this possible. I put together a tape of music at the start, and she was telling me people had a strange look about what this music was and that kind of thing. What you've got to realize is that you've got two Messianic Jews up here who are about to engage in a conversation. You might pray about that. And so the music that you were listening to when you came in that sounded strange and foreign was strange and foreign because it was Messianic Jewish music. So now everyone's going to want to buy the MP3 on the way out. But anyway, Joel, it's a real pleasure to have you with us. And I'm going to introduce Joel so that those of you who don't know who he is can find out. And most of you know, he's a New York Times bestselling author. He's written many books. This is one of the latest ones, if I'm not mistaken, the third Target. And there we've got others that we're going to do as a giveaway in a minute. Joel is involved in a ministry called the Joshua Fund. You want to tell us a little bit about what that is?
Sure. Basically, when I started writing novels, and they were all about disasters in the Middle East, and I began to get a sense from people thinking, well, okay, what do we do to actually make a difference rather than just read one of your books? My wife and I didn't have an answer for that. So as we prayed about it, we ended up starting a ministry called the Joshua Fund. It's to mobilize Christians to bless Israel and her neighbors in the name of Jesus, according to the Abrahamic covenant, Genesis 12, 1 through 3. We believe that even though I'm Jewish and want to reach my people with the gospel, that God also loves the Palestinians and the Syrians and their Iraqis and all the neighbors. So that's what we do. We think of ourselves as a hedge fund or a venture capital fund, let's say, for ministries. So in other words, we will raise this money and then invest it in ministries that are both educating the church about what God's heart is for the region, as well as ministries that are doing evangelism, discipleship, church planting, pastor encouragement, and humanitarian relief, given the poverty and the trauma of disaster and refugees in the region. So that's the objective, and that's the side venture. I mean, that's not really the main thing we do, but it's. I would just do that if I could, but the Lord keeps saying, no, be a novelist.
Keep writing. So, and how recently was it that you moved to Israel?
We moved to Israel in August of 2014. I'm married to my wife, Lynn, for 25 years. We met at Syracuse University in Campus Crusade for Christ. Hmm. And so we have four sons, and they have all come with us. They're 21, 19, 17, and a very precocious 11. Hmm. Caleb, Jacob, Jonah, and Noah. And people say, all right, you got a little
gap
there. So you
work back to the flood.
Yeah. Exactly. And people say, well, why do you have a Noah? You have this big gap between Jonah and Noah. I said, well, that's because Jesus said in Matthew 24 that he's not coming back again until the days of Noah. So we thought, you know, if we're holding him back, we'd better have a Noah. So anyway, that's...
Okay, well...
So, yeah, we moved there in August of 2014. It happened to be at a time when the Palestinian terrorists of Gaza were firing 4,500 thank you presents to, you know, welcome, mm-hmm. Rosenbergs, we're so glad you're here, and why don't you just run right to your bomb shelter immediately? Do not pass go, do not collect 200 shekels. So,
very good. Well,
what exciting way to start.
That's exactly right. Well, what I'm going to do is we're going to talk about Israel, Islam, and the Middle East, And
just the easy topic.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right. If we get to the Middle East, it'll be interesting. But anyway, Joel, I thought could begin by giving us a just kind of a short summary of kind of the topic, and then I'm going to interview him for a short period. Then we'll take a touch of a break, and then there'll be time for questions from the floor. You can see the microphones on the corner, so if you want to ask questions, you can do that. I'll just note that we are recording this for the table, so anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law, because it will go public. Just keep that in mind as you interact with Joel. So Joel, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Daryl. What a joy to be here. Let me just start with just a few minutes to give you a little bit of context, and then happy to go wherever you want the conversation to go. I'm a failed political consultant. That's my actual professional pedigree. Everyone that I ever worked for lost. You laugh, but that's because it's not your career. And I helped Steve Forbes lose two presidential campaigns and about $70 million of his daughter's inheritance money. I worked for Jack Kemp and Bill Bennett, both of who decided not to run, even though they were leading in the polls. I worked for Natan Sharansky, the deputy prime minister of Israel. He got so frustrated with politics, he quit entirely. I worked for Netanyahu, Prime Minister Netanyahu, on his comeback campaign team in the year 2000. It took him 9 years to come back, okay? And I played no useful role. And this was my life. And I decided to get out of politics. I went through political detox. I got out, I got clean. Though in 2016, I need a patch because of all the political activity going on out there now. My friends always are trying to get me to work for some campaign that they want to lose. But anyway, but God's pulled me out of that. So I shifted out of politics and decided to start making things up for a living. Fortunately, there's a title for that, novelist. But of course, my friends think I was making things up when I was working for the political folks. But my first novel was called The Last Jihad. And I began writing it in January of 2001. The Last Jihad, the first page, puts you inside the cockpit of a jet plane coming in on a kamikaze attack mission into an American city. Now, this was 9 months before September 11th. The plot leads from the kamikaze attack to an American president launching a war to take out Saddam Hussein and his regime in Iraq. That book I was finishing on the morning of September 11th, 2001, in the townhouse where my wife and kids and I were living at the time, 15 minutes away from Washington Dulles Airport, where at that moment, Flight 77 from American Airlines was being hijacked, turned around, flown over our house and into the Pentagon. And the novel didn't release until November of 2002. No one had ever heard of it, no one had ever heard of me. But because the book just seemed ripped out of the headlines, ones that had happened, and then we were in the midst of this massive national and global debate over whether we should go to war in Iraq. And so the book hit right into that moment. Mm. And now, don't go to whether you think we should have or shouldn't have. Think about you as a first novelist writing a novel about whether we do or not, and then suddenly, boom. And I had never been on radio or television in my life. And in 60 days, I was on 160 radio and TV shows. Mm-hmm. One of them was in my hometown of Rochester, New York, where I grew up. And I'll just say that actually my first interview was with Hannity on radio and then on Hannity on television. That's how I started. So it was daunting. I felt like Marsha Brady looking into the camera going, anyway, that's an old reference. But anyway, but the next day I was on a radio show from my hometown. And my publicist didn't think, nobody knew me. So it was hard to find people. I knew Hannity because I'd worked with him for a while. I hadn't helped him lose anything, but they didn't know nobody knew me, so they thought, well, hometown, we'll go to a radio show there and try to get him on something. Obviously then many more interested were interested. But all that to say, this guy was on a rock station. I don't know if it's the only station they could find that wanted to interview me. So this was my like second interview. Like the, so it's Wednesday morning. The book came out Tuesday. And I'm on this show with a guy named Brother Wheeze, okay, on a rock station that I remember the station. I didn't listen to it because I wasn't a rocker as they were in the day. And so anyway, he's like, dude, this is amazing. How could you have known that, you know, Muslims were going to hijack a plane and fly it into a city? You know, and I said, well, I didn't know. And he said, wow, this is so amazing. And then this whole thing with Iraq, and now here we are. And he says, are you a Heeb? I said, I'm sorry, what? He said, a Heeb. A Hebrew? Are you a Hebrew? I'm Jewish. Are you? Okay. You know, I thought like Hebrew national hot dog. I'm like, what am I? I'd never actually been called that. So I was just totally unprepared. And I said, well, I'm Jewish on my father's side and Gentile on my mom's side. I said, why do you ask? He said, well, at the end of your book, you got all these characters. They're all talking about Jesus, don't they? I said, well, yes. What are you, an evangelical? A born again? You know, like it just sounded radioactive coming off of his tongue, right? So I said, well, Mr. Wheeze, I believe that Jesus is the Messiah. Yes, I do. I said, well, you know, I don't understand that. How can you be Jewish and believe in Jesus? I said, well, again, Brother Wheeze, it is an interesting story, but I'm sure you don't have time, you know, for me to get into it on the show. And, you know, we could talk about the novel. No. Listen. It's one thing to have a guy who writes fiction and it comes true. To talk to a guy like that, that's one thing. But to have a Jew who believes in Jesus, this I gotta hear, son. And so he held me on to the after the break and forced me to give my testimony.
What a shame.
And it was exciting. And that set into motion so many programs. Mm-hmm. Where we not only talked about the geopolitical realities of being threatened by radical Islam, not all of Islam, but radical Islam, and what that means, and why I'd written a book like this, but it with so many of the shows, a high percentage, people would say, how can you be a name like Rosenberg and believe in Jesus? What is that? And that was the most exciting thing, Daryl. I'd never even imagined. We'd prayed for, you know, the Lord to use this novel in some way to be useful for the kingdom. And that's really what set my new career into motion. And believe me, nobody's more surprised than me, except for my wife.
So you're now a winning novelist.
There's 3 million copies in print. They've all been New York Times bestsellers. Now that you know that I'm a failed political consultant, you know that I couldn't have done this. Listen, I'd never even taken a class on writing a novel. I didn't even read novels as much as I lived in Washington. I read nonfiction. I rarely, Clancy, Grisham. And, you know, I'm Jewish, but I'm one of the few Jewish people in America that didn't get the financial gene. You know, I'm not your stockbroker or your accountant or your hedge fund manager. I'm not your doctor or your lawyer or your chiropractor. I mean, I sort of didn't get the whole, you know, very lucrative set of skills that most Jews get. I got the gift of making things up. So but the Lord has used that the more that I was willing to, you know, surrender it. And I'm just shocked at what has happened, but gratified and the doors that has opened for the gospel, both with Jews, with Muslims, with others. It really is more than I could have hoped for, dreamt of, or imagined.
Well, let's talk about Israel and Islam in the Middle East. And I really like the way you help people sort through thinking about Islam. So I'm going to ask you a very specific question, and that is the difference between radical Islam, apocalyptic Islam, and Islam.
Okay. And how much time did you say we had?
You need to do this in 30 words or less.
Okay. No. Okay. Well, look, let me be clear, and I pick up the point I made a moment ago, but only in passing. We're not talking about 1.6 billion Muslims that are the danger. If you look at all the research that's been done, and a lot of research has been done, the Gallup poll, Pew Research have done just massive surveys throughout all of the Arab world, the Islamic world. The studies keep coming back. You say somewhere between 7-10% of the Islamic world subscribes to a violent jihadist theology or ideology. So you can say, and you should say, that the vast majority of Muslims are not violent. Now, the 7 to 10% doesn't mean they're necessarily engaged in violence, but if you ask them questions from every which way, you find out that they support ISIS, they support a suicide bombing, that they believe in, you know, these types of things. And so you begin to categorize them and say, all right, well, this is a group that believes in violent jihad. So the good news is 90% don't. That's wonderful. But in a world of 1.6 billion Muslims, 10% is 160 million people, right? Mm-hmm. So if you were to group them all in their own country, the Islamic Republic of Radicalistan, for example, this would be, you know, half of the size of the United States. This would be the eighth or ninth largest country on the planet. So it's not insignificant. The issue isn't that the vast majority aren't like this. We should say it. That's good, and we should affirm it. And a large and growing number of the 90% are looking at the 10 and going, or the 4 or the 2, and thinking, if that's Islam, I don't want to be part of it. Okay, so that's the vast majority. Then you break it down to the radicals. And the radicals are people who believe that Islam is the answer and jihad is the way to all the problems that they face. And the shortest way to put it is that radical Islam seeks to attack us as infidels, Jews, Christians, pagans from the West, whatever religion or lack thereof. The goal of attacking us is to get us to leave their holy lands and their holy places. Okay, so they're using violence to achieve an end, which is to get us to leave their part of the world. That's radical Islam as fast as I can summarize it. That's Al-Qaeda, that's the Taliban, that's the Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas, so forth. So that's radical Islam. Now, a subset of radical Islam is what I call apocalyptic Islam. This is the theme of my new series, The Third Target, and the most recent one, The First Hostage. Apocalyptic Muslims are all radicals, and they're all Muslims. But not every Muslim is a radical, but every radical is a Muslim within this context. And not every radical is an apocalyptic Muslim, but every apocalyptic Muslim is a radical Muslim. So what's the difference? Radical Islam wants to attack us. Apocalyptic Islam openly speaks of annihilating us. Why? They don't want to just remove us from a region. They are trying to set up a regional kingdom or caliphate for their Messiah, so-called, the Mahdi, to come. And he will then establish a global Islamic kingdom. And he will establish justice and peace in their eschatology. So this is important. It's important in public policy to understand the difference between Islam, radical Islam, and apocalyptic Islam. The reason apocalyptic Islam is so important and why I'm writing about it now is because the leaders of two nation states, not just one, but two, are driven by this. Iran, their leaders are driven by this apocalyptic eschatology, and the leaders of ISIS, the Islamic State, are driven by it. Now, they have differences. We can talk about them if you'd like, but what's important is to understand this is substantively, significantly, qualitatively different and much more dangerous than just radical Islam and certainly the broader Islamic world.
Okay, I want to come back to the large group. So when we deal with, we talk about...
And let me just say that it's not just important from public policy. I failed to say it's important in terms of the church to understand this in terms of the gospel and in terms of mission. So
okay, so we say that 90% of Muslims are not either apocalyptic or radical. So what are they?
Well, okay, so I wrote a book called Inside the Revolution. In 2009, that's a nonfiction book, very heavy and large, and I don't know why I did that. But anyway, the story is a gift that keeps on giving, so it just my editor didn't have the heart to stop me. In the book, I divide the book into three sections. The radicals, I wasn't focusing much on apocalyptic at the time. That sort of emerged in my clarity of thinking. But the radicals is part one. The reformers are part two. And then the revivalists are part three. All of them are important, but within the area, but then there's others. The vast majority, I would say, are the rank and file, meaning they're not playing tennis. They're in the stands at Wimbledon, and they're watching the radicals take on the reformers. Reformers are like King Abdullah of Jordan, President al-Sisi in Egypt, King Mohammed VI in Morocco, previously you would have said the Turks, although under Erdogan things have gone crazy. Mm-hmm. But people who are saying Islam is the answer, but jihad is not the way, violent jihad. You know, we need reform, we need change, we need openness and moderation, and we need to open things up, not shut things down in terms of Islam. So, but the vast majority of Muslims are rank and file. They are watching the debate, and they have very little voice. But what happens matters, and they're struggling with what is the definition of Islam, because the radicals and certainly the apocalyptics are saying, here's the chapters, here's the verses. Don't tell us we're not Muslims. This is, and then, you know, King Abdullah and King Muhammad, they come out and they say, no. So I have a chapter, if you're interested, in Inside the Revolution, in the radical section, the theology of the radicals. I go specifically to the Quran and the Hadith, their Talmud, as it were, their traditions.
Yep.
And I say, what do the radicals say? What's their theological argument? So we understand it. And there are verses that you can draw right out of the Quran and the Hadith that talk about these type of violence and then justify it. But then in the reformer section, I've got a chapter called The Theology of the Reformers. When they say, no, the radicals are hijacking our religion, what's their theological case? And it's fascinating to read it side by side. And the shortest way to put it is, both cases are actually in the texts. Mm-hmm. And the simplest way to understand it is that in the course of the life of Muhammad, he changed from trying to win over Jews and Christians as people of the book. That's the language he was using when he was trying to say, and I'm the completion of your prophets. I'm the last prophet. I'm the one that Moses said was coming, and that everyone had to listen to me, he said. And so when he was trying to win them over, oh, we're all people of the book, you know, sort of the Rodney King version of Islamic theology. Can't we all just get along, you know, back in the 90s, LA. Okay, never mind. that sort of ecumenical sense of it. But once he realized that the Jews and the Christians weren't going to buy this, he turned violent. And the language of violence, of killing Jews and Christians, this began to emerge. So you have both. And the good news is most Muslims don't read the text. That's good. Or they don't study it, or they don't understand it, or they're not being taught a radical version of it. But once you start to press in, all those violent verses are there. And so this is where the radicals and the apocalyptic Muslims justify this. And so the rank and file is watching the debate, which is just, you know, at a feverish pitch right now, and they're struggling. They can't speak out loud for fear of being arrested or beaten or killed, but they're internally wondering, well, if the radicals are right, is that me? And those that are saying it is, they're joining and becoming foreign fighters. If they're saying, that's ridiculous, if that's Islam, I can't be part of that, they're beginning to turn on satellite television or go on the web and begin searching. Is there any, what's true? Because if it's not this, and this is my whole culture and life, what is true? Is there a God? How do I know him? And this is what God is doing. The God of the Bible is letting the radicals and the apocalyptic Muslims create a firestorm. And it's satanically driven, but it's sovereign. The sovereignty of God is allowing it to happen. Why? To shake the Muslim world like it's never been shaken in 14 centuries, to get people to think. Islam does not encourage thinking. It means submission. You do not think, you do not question, you do not ask. And now they're questioning, now they're thinking, now they're asking. And many are coming to Christ. More Muslims have come to faith in the Lord Jesus Christ and renounced Islam in the last 40 years than in the last 14 centuries. And I think there's much more to come.
So if we put this all together, where it leaves us is that we've got a situation in which the radicalizing of Islam has produced a discomfort for many Muslims. I'm familiar with a ministry called Iran Alive. I'm sure you know what I'm talking Absolutely. About. Actually, it's headquartered in Carrollton here in Texas.
Hormoz Sharia.
Yeah, that's right.
Dear friend, dinner with him in December.
And we've been at conferences where he has spoken, where we've both spoken as well.
I call him the Billy Graham of Iran.
And he's talking about millions of Muslims who watch his show by satellite, many of whom have come to the Lord. The other stories that we hear are about refugees in places like Lebanon, where the church's ministry to Muslims has actually brought many Muslims to Christ. And so I'm assuming you're hearing these stories as well.
We're hearing them because we're engaged in them. The Joshua Fund funds 20% of our funding goes to ministries in the Arab world, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, Iraq. I've been on four trips into Iraq so far, in Jordan numerous times. Actually, I was in Jordan doing research for these books, met with the prime minister, the foreign minister, the interior minister, one of the princes. So we are working on the ground with refugees, with the persecuted church, and we're operating at several different levels, trying to share the gospel with anyone and everyone we can, but mostly to help local ministries do that work. So we're getting firsthand intel back, and that's the key. You have to understand that darkness is falling. Evil is on the offensive in the Middle East and North Africa, and the forces of freedom are in retreat. Much of that, because of the United States, is physically in retreat. That being said, this is the greatest era for the gospel in history. So Hormoz Shariat, the head of this ministry, a former Shia Muslim who came to Christ here in the United States after being a radical Muslim, shouting, "Death to America, death to America." Then he and his wife thought, well, maybe not death to America quite yet. We'd like to go to graduate school over there. So, and it was here in the United States, actually in Southern California, that they both nearly got a divorce, but then both came to faith in Jesus Christ. And now he would say, listen, Joel, you know, from a human rights perspective, from an American perspective, I would love to see Iran open up and have a real reformer government. But I will tell you, this is the perfect storm of conditions right now that's causing 80 million Muslims in Iran to head towards the exits, at least in their hearts and their minds, about Islam. The 40-some years of radical and apocalyptic Islam that they are living under is so horrific that this is what's causing Muslims to think, I'm out. And there are millions of Muslims in Iran who've come to Christ. And as a Jew, I'm incredibly jealous. Hmm. We're not seeing that level of response to the gospel yet. We're seeing more openness among Jews than ever before. We might end up covering some of that. But you couldn't have asked for a better government from the perspective of the gospel than the Ayatollah Khomeini and the Ayatollah Khamenei. And this helps. We've got to think, as American believers, we just have to constantly think there's a public policy perspective, and then there's Jesus's foreign policy. These are not in contradiction. The American government should be protecting us from apocalyptic and radical Muslims and neutralizing their nuclear forces and all the rest of that. At the same time, the church has a separate agenda. We're not supposed to be, you know, defeating and neutralizing our enemy. We're supposed to be loving them and sharing the gospel with them and even loving and serving and praying for them. So we've got to think biblically about these things and understand there's different roles for government and for the church, or we're going to miss the moment.
I have some friends who minister in Albania. Mm. They're dealing with some of the refugees coming out of the Middle East, and they're doing very creative things, like when someone enters into their country, they're giving them a cell phone so they can communicate with one another. But in the cell phone, and they ask the Muslims who they're giving the cell phone to, saying, "We're here to give you a cell phone, but on the cell phone there also is in the chip a Bible. Would you be interested in having it and reading it?" And many, many of the refugees say yes. When he was describing this ministry to me over an email, I was just amazed at, one, the creativity of it, and two, the opportunity that it created, because what happens in some cases is that they're reading these texts and starting to ask questions about what it is that they're reading.
Amen. Amen. We're seeing the similar thing. We don't do it with cell phones, but with providing basically a little MP3 player, mm-hmm. that has the New Testament in the local language, and earbuds. And so what happens is they can listen. You know, they got nothing to do, mm-hmm. right, in these refugee camps. And so you can sit around and listen to the Bible. My first experience with this, at first I thought, well, you know, I don't know, is that going to work? I mean, this was a number of years ago. And so one of my friends on our staff, Joshua Hunt, said, let me take some in to the region and just see what the pastors say, if they can use them. Long story short, my friend dropped some of these off for a guy. He said, I've never used anything like this, but sure, leave some and we'll see what happens. Well, this guy worked for a Bible society. And a Muslim woman, a veiled woman, came in one day and asked for a Bible. And she was very, you know, she's looking all around, she's very nervous. He gave her an Arabic New Testament. She slipped it in, took off. A week or two later, came back in tears because her husband had found the Bible, had yelled at her, screamed at her, and told her, don't ever let this be in this house again. And she said, I've got to bring it back. And so she left it on the desk and started to head to the door, and she was crying. And suddenly this guy remembered, oh, wait, I have these MP3 players. So he said, wait, ma'am. And he explained what it was and said, would you like this? And she says, oh, yes. So what she would do, she would put it under her veil, and while she was vacuuming or washing the dishes and the husband was watching Al Jazeera, she was listening to, you know, John chapter 2, yeah. And nobody was the wiser. Yeah. So God is using all kinds of creative ways, but it requires a heart to say, yes, these people are lost, but they're trapped by Satan. And we were trapped by Satan. And thank God someone didn't say, you know, nuke them till they glow. They said to us, hey, Daryl needs Jesus. Joel needs Jesus. You need Jesus. And we've got to see these people as hostages and not... They're not the enemy. They are often agents of the enemy, but so was Saul. And we're very happy, you in particular, with a story that Luke tells us of the power of how Christ transformed a religious Jewish terrorist in Damascus, I might add, or at least on the road to it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's other people on the road to Damascus that need Jesus right now. So this is the heart we have to have. It comes from the scriptures. Matthew chapter 4 is all about how the as Jesus preaches the gospel of the kingdom, the news spreads through all Syria. Well, what a great verse. We need the news, the good news of the gospel, not the caliphate, the gospel of the kingdom of Christ to go throughout all Syria right now. But it takes risks, it takes courage, and it takes a belief that Matthew 24:14 is true. This gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end shall come. And that's the difference between apocalyptic Islam and biblical eschatology. Apocalyptic eschatology says their job is to kill as many people as possible, and then their Messiah will come. And Christ told us in Matthew 24:14, try to save as many people as possible in the power of the Holy Spirit, and then the Lord will come to set up his kingdom. And this is the photographic negative of these two eschatologies. We both want a kingdom. We both believe the Messiah is coming soon. But their goal is genocide, and our objective is the gospel.
Well, we've got time for questions, so if you have a question, go ahead and line up the mics. Let's talk a little bit about the ministry that goes on to the Jewish community that you're a part of, and then we'll start taking questions from the floor.
Great. Well, the Lord has just, again, opened up these doors for me, you know, just my narrow angle. You know, my father came to faith in 1973. He was raised Orthodox Jewish in Brooklyn. His family of Orthodox Jews had escaped out of Russia in the early years of the 20th century when the Tsar was overseeing the pogroms. And, you know, they got out by the grace of God, got to the United States. And like any good Jewish family, they set up a shop in Brooklyn. I'm not sure where your good Jewish family lived, but if it wasn't Brooklyn, I'm sure it's fine.
Yeah, it's in the city.
Okay. So, but when my father came to faith in 1973, 6 months after my mom, he thought he was the first Jew since the Apostle Paul who believed this stuff. He'd never heard of a Jew who believed in Jesus. He'd never heard of this. He'd never met one. And in 1973, there weren't that many. What year did you come to faith?
In 1976.
Okay. So, and I was 75. And a lot of people, you know, God was moving his spirit, not just among Jews, but the whole Jesus movement. All that to say, I didn't know I was Jewish till the fifth grade. You're like, Joel, your name is Joel Rosenberg. You must have been the dumbest kid in the class. Nevertheless, I didn't know because my parents didn't tell me. My father had such bad experiences with Jewishness that he didn't want to talk about it. He'd married a Gentile. He'd moved to California for a long time. He thought that was Gentile, and that was the promised land, you know, La Jolla, California. my point is that it sort of stumbled out one day, and I was like, what? You're Jewish? Does that mean I'm Jewish? How did this never come up? You know, it's kind of an interesting revelation. And over the course of my life, I've been so intrigued with what does that mean, and why do so few Jews know the Lord? So, I'm just so excited that I live in a season where Jews are so open, and I believe we've gone from about 2,000 Jewish people on the planet who believed in Jesus as Messiah in 1967, that was the year I was born, fewer than 2,000, to today I believe it's more than 300,000. Now, in a world of 14.5 million Jewish people, that's not nearly enough, but the trend line is something I like. And Jews look for signs, and so that's one of mine. And I'm excited by the movement, and I'm excited by the openness. This is right at a moment where a lot of the church worldwide, even in the States, don't want to talk about Jewish evangelism. It's too sensitive. We don't want to offend the Jews. Listen, that's Satan messing things up. Right at the moment where Jews are more interested in talking about Jesus than ever, a lot of the church is shutting down on the topic. And to me, that's the ultimate act of anti-Semitism, is to deny a Jewish person the opportunity to hear that our Messiah has come, and then we get to make a decision one way or another, for or against, but we've got to be engaged in the gospel for all people, starting with the Jews, and of course, the Muslims and everyone else. So that's, I'll stop there.
Okay, well, okay. We've got someone at a mic, so
great.
Go ahead and ask your question.
Thank you so much for coming here.
Sure, honored.
I read the research that Pew done on Muslims across the world, and I remember hearing a speaker talk about it, and he was labeling the 50% or more Jews who want Sharia law to be the law of the land, he was labeling them as radicals. And I wanted you to speak on that. Like, what would you say to this man who was labeling these 50% or more who wants Sharia law to be the law of the land as radical, and how would you like respond to him saying?
Was it the law in a Muslim country or here in the United States?
Anywhere. He said about 50% of the world population of the Muslims want the Sharia law to be the law of the land. Yeah.
I can understand why someone would characterize that as radical. It certainly is radical by American constitutional standards, right? We have freedom of religion, but Sharia law requires a complete abrogation of the Constitution in favor of Islamic law. So that would be unconstitutional. People don't have the freedom to scrap our Constitution. But yeah, Sharia law, when it's really done the way it's supposed to be done, is brutal. It's anti-woman. It's anti-religious freedom. It's anti, it is brutal. I sort of expect a Muslim to want Sharia law because it's what they know. So I don't immediately consider that a radical position in terms of trying to think, would they use violence to go get it? To want something is not the same as to impose something, right? And, I want every Muslim to come to Jesus, but I'm not a crusader or an inquisitor or, I want every Jew to know Jesus, but I'm not a Nazi, right? So there's a difference between, not that the Nazis wanted Jews to come to Jesus. I mean is there have been people who have, done horrible things in the name or at least the impression of Christendom that have been horrible. Wanting people to believe something and forcing something to believe something is different. So the questions that I look at that help me determine whether somebody's a radical is by the definition of, would they use violence to achieve their ends, mm-hmm. right? And Christ specifically told us not to do that, right? He said in front of Pilate, if my kingdom were of this world, then my followers would be using violence to overthrow you, I'm paraphrasing, but and resist this arrest, but my kingdom is not as of this world. It's a kingdom, he's a king, and he's coming, but as followers of Christ, we are not supposed to be engaged in forcibly, imposing our views. And so, did that help sift it through a little bit?
Yeah,
it did. Yeah.
I want to chime in, because if I were to ask people in this room, how many people would want America to live by Christian principles? I'd get a pretty high percentage of people in this room. But if I were to turn around and say, how many people think we should impose that by violence? I'd get a very different number.
I hope so.
Yeah. And so
that's never worked out well for Jews.
I actually think I actually think that one of the important aspects of this conversation that we're having is thinking through and understanding the fact that Islam is not a monolith. That there are a variety of Muslims out there and a variety of ways that Muslims view what's going on in the world out there. There are huge pockets of Islam that dislike what is happening on the more radical elements of the spectrum in Islam. And from a geopolitical point of view, having them as allies in this discussion is almost necessary.
It's essential, absolutely.
And so
and that, it puts us in the same room with people who want, and well, what do you believe? I'm having all kinds of conversations
exactly
with
right.
Muslims about Jesus.
And people who react to violence when it's coming, in fact, their reaction to violence is, that's not us, and please don't equate me with them.
Yes.
That's the reaction that you get. I've been in rooms where I've heard Muslims say this. And so that's a very, very important thing to understand about the complexity of what it is that we're dealing with when you just utter the word Islam. Okay, over here, question.
I have a question about Islam, but before I ask it, when you made the comment about Jewish evangelism, it made me think of a couple of guys that I went to DTS with many years ago who are Jewish brothers, Arnold Fruchtenbaum and Barry Leventhal. Oh,
mm-hmm. Wow.
And they
good
both...
Two good friends. Go ahead.
Yeah. And they both...
Kept good company.
Yeah.
They are great men. Mm-hmm. Both of them have written in detail, not necessarily extensively, but in detail about Romans 1, wherein we are commanded according to them, and I've come to agree with that position, but I surely would like to ask both of you men, because of your Jewish background, where Paul says, you know, it is to the Jew first and also to the Greek, and their position on that is that the evangelism of a church, of an individual, of the church, should begin in the Jewish community. That's how they understand that passage. And they make a great argument for that view. And I was just wondering how you gentlemen feel about that.
Wow, that's a whole doctoral dissertation. I think if I get this right, can I get something for it? Well, you know, letters after my name?
I'll let you give an answer.
You can just be further again.
Okay. First of all, this was the Apostle Paul's model. But I think that, you know, if you were a missionary to Papua New Guinea, it'd be hard to find a Jewish community before you shared with, you know, some sort of person in a jungle. So, I think the church needs to have a very forward-leaning ministry to the Jewish people. And any church in a community that has Jewish people ought to be engaged in reaching Jewish people and not think of it as we love the Jews, therefore we don't want to offend them or anything. That's a mistake. And I know, I forget who the missionary was, maybe Hudson Taylor had a friend who used to send him a check every year, but he would have a little note. Oh, this guy was doing a Jewish ministry, and Hudson Taylor sent him a check, and he would say to the Jew first, and then this guy would send him a check and say, and you know, to the Gentiles, to Greeks as well, although he was in China, but still. see, that the principle was the key, and I think so as much as you can apply the principle as possible, but again, there's places where you're not gonna find Jewish people.
Not to put you on the spot, but because I've never really had a chance to talk to anybody about this. I read their work, but I've not talked to either of them about it.
I'll just let you know, this is a short answer to the question mm-hmm. that fills it in.
And you helped write a book on this.
Exactly where right, I'm going. So. I edited a book with Mitch Glazer called To the Jew First that actually is a look at this whole idea from a variety of angles. So if you, you know,
it's an excellent book. I love it. I should have said it first, but you know,
that's okay.
I highly commend
I'll
it.
I'll go
it's
get it. I'll go first. Get it.
Yeah. So that actually walks through the text, discusses the passages and the principles that are involved, et cetera. So that there's no way in the space of an answer here we can deal with that. But that I'd simply commend that book to your attention. For your attention.
Very quickly, the question about Islam. You've got, obviously Islam is a satanic counterfeit of the Bible and of Christianity, and even down to the idea of the 12th Imam or the Moody, which are, you know...
not Moody, that's a good Bible college, but Mahdi.
Mahdi, okay.
M-A-H-D-I, but anyway... My friends up in Chicago, I just want to, you know.
That's right.
Michael Redownlick and all.
Those guys.
Yeah.
And the second coming of Jesus. The fact, you know, 25 years ago, there was no awareness of the Mahdi or the 12th Imam in a general way in the world. Here we are now confronted by a very vastly growing awareness of Christ's second coming within the Christian community, and then the Islamic counterfeit. My question is, how do you see that in a general end of times prophetic kind of mindset? The fact that we've got both of these now, the awareness is growing, and they're obviously diametrically opposed to each other.
Well, well, for me personally, I'm happy as a clam, and that's not even kosher. So, but we're under the New Testament anyway, so that's hallelujah. Listen, just to be clear, you know, for the record, since we're on the record, you said, I'm really happy about the New Testament and because of shellfish, but it's not my main reason for loving the covenant. But it's on the list. Low pork as well. But anyway, that's just me. Hashtag just saying. Now listen, my interest is I would say almost primarily Bible prophecy. Obviously, I'm interested in geopolitics, but my novels deal with geopolitical what if scenarios, and some of them deal with the what if I marry a geopolitical scenario with taking a look at some of the Bible prophecies that will happen in the end times and thinking, I don't know when they'll happen and I don't know exactly how they will happen. But having studied them a lot, let's run a war game exercise. Let's write a novel or a series of novels that would examine how might we get from the geopolitical situation that we're currently in to that. Wouldn't that be interesting? It interests me, and turns out it's interested a few others. It allows me in a story to engage people's imagination about topics they wouldn't otherwise have shown interest in. To me, that's Jesus teaching me, you know, come follow me and I will make you fishers of men. His way with me is to have me fish by starting off a novel with an explosion, assassination, something horrific, and drawing you in on a geopolitical, spiritual, emotional journey where you're picking up information that you weren't necessarily thinking you wanted, but your adrenaline is pumping and it's now 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning and you're about to email me cursing me because you have to get up in an hour for work and you've been up all night reading. This is my main objective.
Sleep deprivation.
Sleep deprivation. It's worked in every type of terrorist situation, and that's how we deal with terrorism, sleep deprivation. So that's my main objective. So I'm trying to entertain. I'm trying to get Howard Hendricks, we're in the Howard Hendricks Center. He used to say that, you don't want your students to be saying, when does this end? That you want them to say, how does this end? A story you ask, how does this story end? That's what keeps people moving. That's drama. You know, the student who's like, is this on the test? And, when does this class over? And you're thinking that now. I know. And and I'm not sure even the answer. That's his department. But story allows me to pull people in, and I can have Arab characters that somebody might think, that's the bad guy, and it turns out not to be. He turns out to be a hero. Not because he's Arab or not because he's a Muslim, but because he's a human being who sees evil and decides, I'm going to take action. And that helps somebody differently than a nonfiction book or an op-ed, right? My current series, part of it is about ISIS trying to launch a genocidal attack with chemical weapons. And one of the countries they're trying to overthrow is Jordan. And the king of Jordan is an intriguing man to me. He's a descendant of the prophet Muhammad, the false prophet. So I don't start with my books with Islam as a satanically driven, religion. Yes, of course, it was false prophecies and dreams and visions from the enemy. But I don't start that way. I start, because I'm trying to draw people in. And when I was doing this series, the research, I thought, oh, maybe I've sat with two CIA directors to talk about these things and a former head of Mossad in Israel. Maybe I ought to go talk to a Sunni Muslim, maybe in Jordan, if I'm going to write a novel about how these things might play out. And they let me come to sit with their prime minister, their foreign minister, their interior minister, the prince. As a Jew who believes in Jesus, who worked for Netanyahu, you know, I'm not exactly a poster child for the person they want to spend time with. Especially when I told the ambassador in Washington, and the reason that what this book is about is the potential overthrow and assassination of your king and kingdom. Would you help me? Not to do that, but to run the war game. Let people see, why is that bad? Not just for your country, but for ours and for the world. And but this allows me to go, and what's amazing on that trip was how many, sitting with the prime minister, and he's saying, okay, yeah, I want to talk about your topic, but how can we get more Christians to come to Jordan? How come Israel's getting all the Christians? I said, well, have you been reaching out to Christians? Well, no, not exactly. Well, you know, let's start there. And we ended up getting, I had a 2.5-hour conversation with one of the highest ranking people in the country about Jesus. And he was making the case to me, you know, Jesus was probably baptized on the eastern side of Jordan. because the Gospel of John says that John the Baptizer was in Bethany, right, on the other side of the Jordan. Well, other side from where? From the Israel side. And so he's like, you know, Elijah was on our side. That's where he was born. And then where did he go up to heaven? Our side. Okay, where did Elisha get the mantle? Our side. I mean, it was fascinating. I was like, I am in a meeting with a descendant of Muhammad. This is a physical descendant. This was from the family. And we're talking about Jesus. We're talking about the prophets. This is not a photo op. We're having a conversation. Why? Because I came to write a book about the overthrow of his country. And this wasn't the king. But I believe you can engage people with common threats and respect and a lot of prayer and a desire to love people for the gospel. And can I just give one other anecdote on this topic? Because, okay, so several years ago, a friend of mine who lives in Morocco in business happened to give a copy of one of my novels to the director of Islamic Affairs. The guy is in charge of 33,000 mosques and was one of the advisors to the king on Islamic Affairs, also a family descendant from Muhammad. And so this guy read one of my novels, and he was coming to meet Condoleezza Rice, this is back in the Bush administration, in Washington, and he said, hey, does your friend live in Washington, right? Yeah. Yes. Could I go have dinner with him? This is a fascinating novel. Really? So my friend calls me, and I said, who is this really? Come on. The guy wants to have... I said, we just had Passover here. You're saying that the head of Morocco's 33,000 mosques wants to come and have dinner with me? Okay. So fascinating. And we had a lovely dinner party for him. We invited some friends over. Then he invited me to Morocco. I said, okay. So we made the plan. I went over. He had a dinner party in his house. And after saying an Islamic blessing over the meal, which was an amazing meal, I might add, lamb and the whole rice and the big piles of stuff. It was just amazing. So obviously I had too much. But he says, he sits down and he's got the head of Homeland Security from Morocco and all these other, bigwigs. It was, 20 people in the room. And he says, okay, something's been bothering me. I said, okay. Your name is Rosenberg, right? That's Jewish, isn't it? But when I was at your house, you describe yourself as an evangelical Christian, a follower of Jesus. I've been wondering about that. I don't understand how you can be Jewish and believe in Jesus. Would you share with me and my friends, how is that possible? I'm thinking to myself, Lord, you are kidding me. Are you, if I was Elaine in Seinfeld, get out. Are you kidding me? You're going to get, okay, let's have that conversation. Now, that's not a normal day in the life of everybody, but I believe this is the moment. And we've got to distinguish between people who are evil and people who are lost. And even the people who are evil are lost. And sometimes we're going to be Stephen, and we're going to preach the gospel right to the religious terrorist, Saul, and we're going to die for it. And sometimes, You know, we're going to be sharing the gospel with somebody and their eyes are going to open and they're going to come into the kingdom. And sometimes we're just planting seeds and we're not going to see fruit right away. But this is the moment. This is what God is doing. Don't see the evil. We have to understand the evil. It's evil. Jesus didn't say that these are not enemies, that they're misunderstood. You haven't studied them carefully. No, he says they're enemies. Fine, they're enemies. Do you love them? That's a big convicting question. And I meet a lot of my readers who say, I didn't before I started reading your book, and I'm still struggling now, but I'm sort of getting your point, one of my points.
Okay, time for one last question.
Sorry, that was an extended DVD answer, and I apologize.
We can just kind of go back a little bit to this progression of career and political consultant.
Yes.
And then I guess I'm interested in a little bit about, okay, I want to write a book, and then the topic in question came up, or I'm interested in being an advocate of Jesus Christ to the community of the Muslim world. Just kind of walk
I never thought that.
Walk a little bit.
I will. I was despondent when everybody lost and I couldn't.
It's tough to lose.
Is tough to lose. And, and then you think, well, who's going to, at some point, someone is going to look at the resume and go, why exactly am I hiring you? Like, there are other people, like winners who know how to do this. And I just thought, Lord, you've got to be kidding me. And then I was, just doing some consulting and I didn't have a client for a while. And then somebody wanted me to write a book about some provision in the Puerto Rican tax policy that, I was like, oh, I can't. And this guy was offering me $40,000 to write this book about, to get rid of this one provision. And I said to my wife, I don't care if we go bankrupt, which we nearly were at that point. I said, I can't write a book that nobody cares for. My life is going nowhere. 10 years of doing this, I could have gone to DTS several times. I could be a missionary. I could, I could have gone to graduate school in some other way. Lord, you're killing me here. I mean, what is the point? I was very low, and I began to get the sense that that he wanted me to write a series of novels about Ezekiel 38 and 39. And I went, I don't think so. No. You don't understand. I'm sorry. That's who I was. And I was like, Lord, anything but that. Not Puerto Rican tax policy, but pretty much anything I'll do for you. I'm narrowing a few categories I don't want to do for you, but just come on. My writing, I'm writing books no one reads. I'm writing op-eds no one cares about, speeches no one listens to. So these are my loaves and fishes. You can take this. You can bless this. You can break this and feed people with this. Please. But don't make me write about prophecy. I don't want to be one of those prophecy nuts. I don't want to look like I'm from Area 51. I'm trying to, I don't want to do that. And the Lord was not having any of that. And so I said, Tim LaHaye sold 65 million copies. You don't need another one. And I don't even read novels and I don't even write, I don't. I admit, I guess now on the record, had the Lord said, now would you just take a deep breath and have some decaf and, just do what I say and, maybe I'll put you in Morocco. Maybe you'll be sitting in Rabat sharing the gospel with a Muslim who oversees 33,000 mosques. I might have gone, oh, well, that'd be fun. Or, maybe you'll get to sit with the president of the Philippines and, talk about Jesus. And, that'd be fun. And maybe the heads of the CIA and... I didn't see any of that. I just thought, this was ridiculous. I don't want to be identified. So I came kicking and screaming into, I am not a good strategist for myself. Political strategy was my career and communication strategy, and I think we've made it clear now that I don't know how to do it. And this was the Lord's point, in part. One, to take me not to Dallas, which I love, but he wanted my political communications graduate school to be in very hard-edged international and national politics, to hear how to make an argument to skeptics and to cynics, to teach Bible prophecy not to the choir in Dallas, but to people who think you're a lunatic, and they're within the church, okay, who don't want to deal with the 27% of scripture that's eschatology, and yet have to, need to. So that's part of it. He wanted me to learn from Rush Limbaugh and Bibi Netanyahu and Steve Forbes and Bill Bennett and Jack Kemp how to make an argument and then sift it through biblically and say, okay, now take a little here and there, but now go here. That's part of it. But the other part was to write political thrillers, Tom Clancy-esque political thrillers, but I needed 10 years of geopolitical experience. I needed not primarily, in my case, I guess, from the Lord, the theological training in the ancient languages. What I needed was to know how to blow things up and make things exciting in a very realistic political thriller, so that in when I fished, I would be drawing people in who wouldn't be thrown by that. Well, that's ridiculous. That would never happen. Because of the stories he wanted me to tell. He wanted me to be telling stories about prophecy, not how they would exactly happen or when, but to get people thinking, well, these, I never even knew about these prophecies. How would it? And the church is hardly teaching prophecy anymore, so this is God's way for me. But I'm just saying, I didn't want to do it. I thought it was ridiculous, and this is why God gets all the credit, and I get zero, because if it was up to me, you know, I wouldn't have done it. And I'm just grateful that the Lord is merciful to morons. You know, I'll close with this truth sentence, actually. My wife literally, I mean, she has the spiritual gift of discernment. I have the gift of obliviousness. And my whole life is trying to trust the Lord to override my inability to see the obvious. And as a Russian Jew, I'm a pessimist about everything. The glass is half full. There's a hole in it. It'll all be gone by tomorrow, maybe by today. So I have to trust God that my pessimism about life helps me write worst case scenario thrillers. But it has to be balanced by the Spirit and a wonderful Gentile, Spirit-filled wife who said, it's not all bad. Jesus is moving. He does love you and all of us. So let's just not get absorbed only in the bad. That's my story, and unfortunately, I'm stuck with it now, because that's what God is doing. And I'm great. I mean, unfortunately, I mean, all the parts about me that's so not pleasant. But I'm grateful that God is a great God. He's a prayer. I'll close with this. I had an Indian pastor, literally from India, who discipled my wife and I in college, and he was the on-site Hendrix. Hendrix was only an audio tape for me, but this Dr. Koshi from India, he would say, Joel, lean. Vis of a prayer, hearing and a prayer, answering God, a wonder-working God, which I often needed English to English translation to understand. What are you talking about? What? Joel and Lynn, we serve a prayer hearing and a prayer answering God, a wonder-working God. And it's so true. It's so true.
Let's thank Joel for...
Thanks for listening to the Table Podcast. For more podcasts like this one, visit dts.edu/thetable. Dallas Theological Seminary. Teach truth, love well.